Yes, though, but I finished my PhD as a special situation.
Mm-hmm.
In that you can't just look for a job. I mean, I had, let me turn this off. I had the draft board was after me all the way.
So I guess one thing that I'd like to know more about, I mean, you came to the U.S. You were not a U.S. citizen when you enrolled at Cornell.
Not a U.S. citizen when I graduated from Cornell.
In terms of your PhD?
I didn't become a U.S. citizen until 1949.
Okay.
And even when Wallace Broad offered me a job at the Bureau, he says, let's wait 6 months until you go through and become a citizen, then we can hire you as a citizen rather than get an exemption for a foreigner.
Okay.
So I was not a citizen all this time, but that didn't stop the draft board.
Mm-hmm. Even though you're technically from a country that we were at war with?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, like my friend in Orlando, I mean, he tried to enlist in the Marines. Now, they wouldn't take him when the war broke out. So then he went to the Army, and they did take him. And then he got citizenship within 3 months.
Wow.
Because he volunteered in the Army. And from there on, his career went on as a citizen.
Did you have a sense, and I do want to hear about the draft board coming after you, but when you were finishing up your degree, did you have a sense of where you wanted to go? I mean, you know, there are options, academia, industry, government research.
Academia was out.
Why?
Everything was out except war industry. Otherwise, the draft board will get you.
Hmm.
In other words, if you say, all right, I'd like to go and work at the Mellon Institute, out. 3 months later, you're in the Army. You want to work at, I don't know, University of Chicago. Maybe there's a choice job there for a Hungarian-speaking organic chemist. Who knows? No, teaching jobs were out. Had to be war industry. And on the other hand, that was in the days when no chemist was going without a job.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Miller found me a job in the war industry before I ever finished. And I started with General Chemical, which was a division at the time of Allied Chemical and Dye, which later on merged God knows with whom.
Mm-hmm. If you had had your choice, would you have wanted to stay in academia, or did you want?
Okay. Yes, I think I would.
Okay.
And I tried a couple of times later on to find something in academia, but I couldn't. I had an interview when I was in industry. This was after the war now, no restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
You could be a street sweeper if you wanted to, and you wouldn't get drafted. And I had an interview with Swarthmore College, which is a very good...
I live in Swarthmore.
All right, so you know about Swarthmore. All right, well, the pay there would have been half of my industrial pay. And I said, I can't afford that. When I took the job with the federal government, I took a cut.
Mm-hmm.
Not much, but slight. So of course I got into the academia, but in the like that, when I wound up dishing out money to academic scientists, which was not until 1960. And And the net result is that I still have many, many academic scientists as personal friends, not because of the money I gave him, but because I think we had a very good relationship. One friend is dead now. Well, we got acquainted because I supported his research, and we discovered we both liked to ski, and we went on many ski trips together until he was 2 years older than I was, so he gave up a little before I did, mm-hmm. about the same time. And I had one very interesting experience. I don't know if you guys know about this. I like to ski. You got that message. And like to ski in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So I went pretty regularly. I found a place that was quite inexpensive for me in the best ski area in Europe, probably in Davos. And this is after I retired. And I also, by then, I had some very good relations with some high ups in Hungarian chemistry. And the reason for that is this. In 1985, there was a rotating meeting of photochemists, that International Conference of Photochemistry, which is held here and there. In 85, it was held in Budapest. And of course, I went to Budapest in part because I grew up there, in part because I used to be a photochemist, so it was appropriate. And I got to be quite friendly with the people who put on the meeting, and especially one who was a member of the Academy, Hungarian Academy, and the director of the Academy's Photochemistry Institute. And so after that, after the meeting, every time I go skiing in Europe, I make a point to stop in Budapest for a few days just to see my friend, Ferenc, what was his last name? Doesn't matter. In the meantime, in the U.S., I was consulting for these universities. I added up to about 65 about where the money is and how can you, the individual faculty member, how can you, what are the best chances of approaching the AEC, well, DOE now. For funds, or how are the best chances of approaching maybe the Navy for funds and things like this. And to do that, I'd spend a couple of days in Washington every year. And the biggest, the most money was from the National Science Foundation. And I had a good friend who was director of chemistry at NSF, Ken Hancock, who died, unfortunately, very young. Mm-hmm. In 1990, I think it was 1990, I may be wrong by a year or two, I visit Washington, have lunch with Ken Hancock, talk about what their interests are, whatnot, and telling him after Washington, I was going to stop somewhere else and then go to Switzerland to ski for a while. Oh, he says, are you going to stop in Hungary? He knew I had good friends. Yes, I said, I am. You're going to see any chemists? Oh, yes, this guy is very VIP in chemistry. Well, he says, communism is over now, and the Hungarian chemical community doesn't know much about it. U.S. and NSF and anything we do internationally otherwise, maybe we could somehow try to get educated. Maybe we could have some kind of a workshop, a joint workshop, a half a dozen Hungarians, a half a dozen Americans, and a deserted island somewhere. He was thinking out loud. I said, Ken, I bet you that the Hungarians would be delighted to have a get-together like that. On an island, on a mountaintop, it doesn't matter. They'll do everything they could to make it a success, but except for one thing. They probably won't be able to contribute a plot nickel, because Hungarian currency wasn't worth a damn. And so he says, why don't you look into it? So, all right, I look into it. I stop and visit my friend in Budapest, and I tell him this idea and whatnot. And it's exactly as I predicted. They'd love to have it. They'd love to get together. They'd been eastward oriented for 20 years, 40 years, whatever it was. They want to at least balance orientation, but they don't have anything to contribute to start it. So I come back, do my skiing, come back, talk to Ken, and I said, Ken, was exactly like I predicted. All right, let me think about it, he says. And about a week or 10 days later, the phone rings and it's Ken Hancock. He says, I think I got the answer. He says, how would it be if we sent an American delegation to Hungary? They wouldn't have to contribute any kind of hard currency. How would they take to that? I said, I bet they'd love you to pieces. So the next year I went back, saw the same guy. Yes, he loved us to pieces. They'd open up, they'd have red carpet, everything. Now the thing was for us to do on this end is put together a delegation representing the whole broad field of chemistry. And Ken and I did that together. And I think that was a remarkable success, and he repeated it in other countries. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we took two organic chemists, because it's a big field. Two physical chemists, because it's a very varied field. One inorganic chemist, and one polymer chemist. That covers chemistry pretty well. And then there was Ken, who was the generalist for NSF, and myself, who was sort of the journeyman on this. And who was it? One more person. I don't think there was. So, we went and we were planning to go for a week, except the Americans, if they wanted to, they could come a week or two, a few days earlier, give a lecture in Debrecen, a lecture in Veszprém or whatever, if the Hungarians wanted them to. And it was terrific. The Hungarians took us to every university and every research institute in the 5 working days we had. And the evening we had a couple of dinners, they treated us to dinner and things like this. And the delegation was very, very good. It was mainly young people. The only real senior person was Al Bard, who was a member of the academy and whatnot, whatnot. But of the other 5, 4 of them got elected to the National Academy of Sciences within a year. So they were right on the verge of it. And a couple of them were Hungarian born. By the way, you notice the ACS just got the latest, what's the biggest award the ACS has?
The Priestley? The Priestley Award, or?
Yeah. No, Priestley or something. Anyhow, the big award. And the guy who got the award is A, Hungarian born. B, he was on this delegation. Is Peter, As I get older, I have trouble with names. Mm-hmm. Older names. Peter's. He's a Juto. He's an organic chemist, very much a mechanistic organic chemist. Peter Stang. He just got the award. And of course, Hungarians have gotten big, big awards in chemistry. I mean, George Ola is a Nobel laureate, Hungarian. Hmm. And Peter Stang is hoping to get a Nobel laureate. Nobel Prize award. No, Peter Stang got the, yes, it's the Priestley Award that he just got. And Peter was on that delegation, one of the organic chemists. Julius Rebek, who was born and raised in Hungary, was the other organic chemist. Veronica Vajda, a physical chemist from University of Colorado, was one of the physical chemists. Another one was from Brandeis, I can't remember his name. And we had quite a... And Tom Bard was for analytical. My friend Tom Meyer from UNC was the inorganic. Maybe we had one more. We had inorganic endopolymer, yes. And we had quite a hassle for polymer chemists because there was a fellow named Kennedy at one of the Ohio universities, and he's Hungarian born. And we offered him to come on the delegation, and he had some conflict, couldn't come. But he was dying to go. And then we switched, and we got Pierce from Brooklyn Poly. He's not Hungarian born. And after we offered it to Pierce, then Kennedy came back. He said he found some other way of changing his schedule. He'd still like to go. He said, sorry. Mistaken, but Hungarian-born chemists, among the prominent chemists in the U.S., are knee-deep. I mean, an awful lot of them here, and many of them have done very, very well. And George Ola comes to mind, Peter Stang. Although Stang was something like 4 years old when he left Hungary, so that's not exactly Hungarian-born, but George Ola had all his education in Hungary. And,
so can you tell us a little bit more about going from your... you finished your degree at Cornell, and you... Miller found you this position at General Chemical Company in New York City. By this time, I think your family had made it to New York City. Your father and your sister.
Yes. My father and sister were there.
Okay. How was it transitioning from your graduate career into this industrial position?
Well, General Chemical at that time was quite interested in fluorine compounds, and fluorine compounds was a very new subject in industry. I mean, there are not many industries doing fluorine compounds.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was still classified, some of the fluorocarbons that are used in as coolants in nuclear reactors, things like that. That was still, couldn't be touched. I mean, General Chemical was not involved in that. I got one patent out of my 10 months or so in with General Chemical, and that's the silliest patent probably in the patent literature.
What's it for?
It is, let me see, that was mine. All right, give me a rod of some sort. All right, my job was remember, I was in fluorine chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
What everybody, what people at General Chemical were interested in,
mm-hmm.
was you have a, what was known is that if you had CF3 here, you could oxidize the CH3 group and get the acid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This becomes the carboxylic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And, but to get CF3 in there is very difficult and expensive. I think it still is. This is through 1944. Okay. So my boss had the bright idea, if you have CF2Cl, which is almost as electronegative as this, and you have CH3 here, you oxidize this, and you'd get the acid, and that would be a very strong organic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's known that this is a very strong organic acid. This is a little bit stronger. Okay. So the boss comes to me, he says, I want you to do this. I said, all right, how do you want me to oxidize it? He says, that's up to you. But it would have to be a vapor phase oxidation. And how do you oxidize organic compounds those days? And again, talking 1944, you need a catalyst. What's the catalyst? The metal oxide, and the best results have ever been at the time, and probably since, vanadium pentoxide. Vanadium pentoxide is a high-level, high-oxidation state oxide. And you mix vanadium pentoxide, heat the hell out of this, and it should work. And General Chemical had masses of supplies of vanadium pentoxide because they were the country's largest supplier of sulfuric acid. And you make sulfuric acid by taking the trivalent, or four-valent sulfur and oxidize it to six. But this vanadium pentoxide that we used, the company used for oxidizing, making sulfuric acid in truckload quantities, was kept under lock and key. In fact, it was kept under such lock and key that our division couldn't get hold of it. And the boss comes around a couple of weeks later, well, how is the oxidation? I say, I can't get any vanadium pentoxide. He says, well, use any damn oxide. I said, all right, use any damn oxide. The nearest oxide I could get was aluminum oxide, Al2O3. Nobody cared about Al2O3. So I mixed up the hydrocarbon with aluminum oxide and see what comes out of it, and something new and different came out of it. Mm-hmm. That's where the patent is. The only catch is aluminum has a very strong affinity for fluorine. So the aluminum pulled the fluorine out. And there's no, so they insisted getting a patent on it. Nobody's ever going to use it,
mm-hmm.
because fluorine is very expensive to put in. You sure as hell don't want to pull it out and get it, and pay somebody a patent, a royalty for it. So that, I don't know if they ever used vanadium pentoxide for it, but I mean, elementary chemistry said that for oxidation with oxides, vanadium pentoxide, because it's a high valence state, is the one the most likely, if it doesn't work with vanadium pentoxide, it's not going to work with anything. Mm-hmm. We never tried it. I didn't stay long enough. I don't think they ever tried it either. All right, so that was the funny one. Here for the, in the same company, we couldn't get, we didn't need much, maybe 5 grams or something to try it. Couldn't get it.
So
you probably bought it from the Russians or something.
So you stayed at a General Chemical Company for approximately 1 year,
yeah.
44 to 45, and then you went on to the General Anilin,
right.
Anilin and Film Corporation. How did that come about?
A year earlier, before I was still at Cornell, I registered at the Employment Clearinghouse, the ACS, and this the head of this department at General Anilin interviewed me, and then he looked at my draft status and said, "I can't. There's no point in my thinking of hiring you because we hire you, and 3 months later you're in the army." So he was not interested. But between these two events, the war ended,
mm-hmm.
so he didn't have to worry about it. And I remember this guy, I wrote to him back, I said, "You didn't offer me a job at the ACS meeting a year ago because of the draft board, but draft boards are gone, the war is over, are you interested?" And he was, and offered me $1,000 more than General Chemical was paying me.
So did you want to leave General Chemical?
I mean, everybody left. About 40 or 50% of the people left there. They were. It was the worst laboratory conditions that you could ever imagine.
Is it just because the groups weren't working well with each other, or were there other problems? That...
No, they had some excellent people.
Mm-hmm.
The laboratory was not air conditioned. It was so all the windows are open. Was next to a glue factory, and the glue factory was sending out glue vapors right and left and all, and the pay was low.
Uh-huh.
So when, as soon as the war power restrictions were lifted, about 60% of the people at General Chemical left. This was as an example, the. When they offered me the job, they never showed me the lab. The job offer came in headquarters in downtown Manhattan, in the executive suite. But they had some very, very good people at General Chemical,
mm-hmm.
and they all left. And and they didn't really try to keep you. I mean, my boss told me when I told him I was going to want to leave, he says, "Well, if you're going to leave, we're going to tell your draft board." I said, "Oh, go ahead, tell the draft board the war is over." And the draft board didn't care, I didn't care. So nobody thought it was. They were working on a new lab mm-hmm. in New Jersey, which opened, I think, about a year and a half, 2 years later. And it was the Allied lab, and this was General Chemical, part of Allied.
Mm-hmm.
I visited that lab later on in probably my other capacity as, but that was much later when I was working for the Army, yes. Mm-hmm.
So when you went over to the new company, were you just assigned a division to work in? Did you have any choice?
Yes.
Okay, you were assigned where to work. Where did you wind up, where were you focused for your research?
Well, this was the so-called process development division.
Mm-hmm.
And they were working on dyes. And dyes seemed like very interesting molecules to me.
Why is that?
Color.
Just simply because... color.
It's there's an awful lot of, to get color you have to have a lot of conjugation, and there's a much much more interesting than just having, say, a CH3, CH2, CH2 10 times and then CH3 at the end. There's nothing very exciting on that. Some of those diet structures are fascinating. And I enjoyed them later on at the Bureau of Standards, which brings me back to my question to you about indigo.
I have the research librarian at CHF looking into it.
I know, that's very nice. Yeah. It is a fascinating question. I mean, indigo is a fascinating molecule. That's indigo, in a trans form.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, as of 1990 at least, there is no cis form. But you take this, I mix it up with oxalate, heat it up with oxalate chloride, you get the oxalyl derivative of cis indigo.
Mm-hmm.
You hydrolyze the oxalyl derivative of cis indigo, what do you get? Trans indigo. So it's a very puzzling thing, and it's a lot of other things puzzling. This absorbs at 600 nanometers. It's not soluble, no. I tried various indirect approaches, and one of the things that got me started on this is many years ago I walked into the chemistry building at Columbia University, and in the lobby, as you come in, they have a little, at that time, they had a little exhibit, this, that. And they had a formula for cis indigo, and under it, it said indigo. So Nick Turo was a good friend, and at that time, he was a senior professor there. I said, Nick, you guys have the wrong structure for indigo in your lobby. He went down, I was very embarrassed. Changed it real quick. But the cis indigo is a mystery. I worked a lot with thio indigos. Instead of NH, you got a sulfur.
Mm.
There you got cis and trans. But we discovered that first at the Bureau of Standards. Others thought that there was only one kind. And when I was in the dye industry, they only thought there was only one kind. It's not. So there's still, well, in 1970, 75, there's still a lot to be done about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much has been done. But the cis indigo is a couple of papers in the literature going back to 1930. Mm-hmm. Somebody thought he saw cis indigo, but no, he did not see cis indigo, so it's a mystery.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd like to know if... I mean, then came flash photolysis, and then came super flash photolysis, and they could get to a real fraction of a millisecond. All these things that you still don't see that damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had friends working on it, and the Russians were working on it, we were working on it, and the Germans were working on it, all the Max Planck Institutes, and And it's a mystery. It's really a mystery.
So did you start your interest in the Indigo while you were at Anilin, or was that something that started at the National?
It's funny. Yes and no, both. I was at General Anilin, and I was leaving by mutual consent to go to the Bureau of Standards work at Wallace Broad. And I knew what Wallace Broad had in mind, and General Anilin had no objection to giving me some samples. And Wallace Broad at that time, what he had in mind was substitution on spectra. Here's a die on dice. Here's a die with no substitution. And there's a spectrum. You put a chlorine in the 5 position, the spectrum changes like that. Put a chlorine in a 6 position, the change is different. That sort of thing. So I'd worked with thio indigos at General Anilin just before leaving. And there was quite a collection of thio indigos with this substitute and that substitute and no substitute and whatnot. So we could make a study of a series. And I asked them, and they were perfectly happy for me to take small samples, which is all we're talking about, of a bunch of these thio indigos with different substituents and look at the spectra, which they were not interested in, and see what we could find. So here I am at the Bureau of Standards with a very nice collection of this thio indigo and this thio indigo and so forth, and looking at them, and then we see with a new Cary spectrometer that the spectra vary. If you get a spectrum today at 1 o'clock, you get a spectrum. And you go home and you come back the next morning and the spectrum is going to be different. That didn't make any sense. The Cary was foolproof. Something's happening to the dye. What's happening to the dye? What we discovered that was happening is the thio indigos, which has a central double bond, they always have an equilibrium between cis and trans, depending on the lighting. And if you leave them in a spectrometer where it's dark, then it goes from a mix of light plus dark to only that which is stable in dark conditions. And we unscrambled the whole thing and found out what it was and what the pure cis and what the pure trans would look like. So this was all great for thio indigo because thio indigo does this. So let's take a look at indigo. Indigo doesn't do it. And then let's take a look. Indigo and thio indigo, the difference is the half the molecule. The half indigo, half thio indigo, you have one NH group and one S. The half thio indigo doesn't do it either. So we had to find out why and how, and we did to a certain point, and we know why indigo doesn't do it, because what I carefully neglected to do here, this oxygen is really out here. This hydrogen is really out here. And the hydrogen bond stabilizes the trans. Now, the thio indigo, the NH group is replaced by a sulfur. No hydrogen. Mm-hmm. No hydrogen bond, no nothing. So this is what's fascinating, that even one hydrogen will stabilize this, so it will stay in this position, and it will not go to this position. Hmm. And I don't know if that's still true. I mean, I got the Bureau of Standards in 1950, I think, so that's 75 years or something.
What made you want to go to the National Bureau of Standards?
Well, they were doing basic research. Government research is basic research. Industry is interested in applied research with a dollar sign at the end of every equation. And the government is not interested in dollar sign, as we all know. And seemed like a good opportunity, and as I say, I took a salary cut to go there, and then I stayed with the government for 35 years.
So I'm curious, before we get to the Bureau, and because I think there'll be a lot to explore there, I'm wondering what new terrain you covered while you were at General Anilin that built upon what you had done at Cornell. It seems like the year of General Chemical, there wasn't a whole lot of new learning that went on. But it does seem like at General Anilin, you had an opportunity to apply some of your mechanistic training around organic synthesis.
No.
No?
No. This old German-Austrian department head, he was very much in line. I mean, he was a very, very classical sort of a chemist. I still remember one time, one of my colleagues had wanted to show him something. General Allen at that time acquired a spectrophotometer, which was not a Cary. It was, it did not measure absorbance, it measured transmission. And he wanted to show the boss that here the spectrometer shows that this and this are the same. I mean, the curves were the same on the spectrometer. And the boss said, "Ah, spectrometer, who cares about spectrometer? We never had those when I was going to school." I mean, obviously nobody could convince him that science is really progressing beyond when he was in school in 1910 or whenever. I never had much real interest in him or what was going on. I mean, I did what they wanted me to do. I got some dyes for them, and that was it. You know. Then the dyes got much more interesting when we could compare them
right.
at the Bureau of Standards yeah. with a real good instrument and see what's going on a micro scale, micro, even smaller than micro.
Maybe that'd be a good place to start tomorrow morning.
I think so.
Hmm?
Maybe that's a good place to start tomorrow morning.
Up to you guys.
Sure.
I suggest maybe you read this before tomorrow.
Sure.
It's only a couple of pages. And this tells you what happened as I got to Bureau of Standards and what I did pretty much at the Bureau up to a certain point. And then I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have them. But
sure.
Well, I think
I think I have two of them. If you want two,
I think one is fine.
One is fine.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
not long. Now, the other thing that I did, and I don't know. Well, that comes later, of course. When I started working for the federal government, I had some opportunities that others couldn't have had. I started a series of international conferences. The first one was held, again, in photochemistry, because I happened to fall into photochemistry. And the first one was held in 1962. And 1962, a lot of new things were happening in photochemistry. It so happened I picked a good time. The Army gave me money to bring people from all over the world to Durham. The meeting was held here in Durham. And the photochemists liked the meeting. And I think that series of meetings, first it was every three or four years and every couple of years. I think that series of meetings is still going on. So it was something that was needed. I'm not saying that somebody else may not have started it a couple of years later. Here's what I looked like in 1962. But that's only about conferences. So conferences are something that sometimes very significant things come out of conferences, but not always. But this is the one I think you should read. Do you have the other one?
Yes, I do.
All right, you got it.
Perfect. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.